just thought of a line from Jung that life is a luminous pause between two great mysteries, like the two chimes of a bell. I'm adding that. So now my task is harder. I have to weave in dragonfly, happiness, and the apocalypse. And maybe I should begin with the, was it Gandalf speaking to Frodo who said, what matters is what to do with the time given us? Yeah, that's the question, actually. That's the conclusion of my talk. What will we do with the time given us between the luminous pause between two great mysteries, birth and death? And the mystery of birth and death and the life-death-life cycle of all things. What shall we do? And I want to try to talk about the apocalypse, and Yeats's poem is an apocalyptic poem. And why? Why do I want to talk about that? Just to be disturbing. No, I want to talk about it because it's related to the theme that we're just exploring in various ways, which is, what's our theme? You tell me. Okay, so if we're born for these times, what times? What time do we find ourselves in? And I want to speak about the apocalypse, and to do so, I have to speak mythically and symbolically, which is the same thing as saying speak about reality. And I'll be weaving, I hope, in and out of mythopoetic truths and scientific truths, and the space between things might get a little blurry. Maybe you're familiar with the Celtic notion of thin places, the thin place between worlds. The shamans were the ones who were able to pass between worlds, we're told. And to talk about the apocalypse is to move closer to that space, the thinness between worlds, so to speak. So I'm just giving you a fair warning that that's how I intend to talk for the next few minutes. And I want to empower you, as you're always empowered, as you let me know, to disagree with me. And that's fine. And at the very least, imagine that I am a witch stirring a cauldron of fiery, underworldly, bubbling lava, and from time to time I'm throwing in some raven wings and the feet of chickens, and you can throw in a few things too if you want. We're stirring the cauldron. And here's why I want to talk about the apocalypse. Because every culture that we know of has some version of it. And that's always interesting to me. Some way of saying the end is coming. And after a while, you would think, well, you know, we've been around a while. So do we just give up that notion? And you would think modern people would give up that notion. But have you ever heard of Hollywood? By the way, if you want to make a career, a solid career, making something that people will always buy, make movies about the end of the world. It never goes away. You can just keep doing it. Like zombies, Bruce Willis. You can make up any scenario and people will still buy it. They'll consume it. We're hungry for it. And the question is why? Why are we hungry for apocalyptic ideas and visions? And it's complicated. I think, there are lots of tributaries. I'll just give you one possibility here. Why do human beings muse about these things? Well, the first thing I'd like to say is that one of the fundamental realities of being a human being is we have an imagination. And to have an imagination means we can imagine the future. That's one of the things that we, as far as we know, we could be wrong, that we don't share with the rest of the animal kingdom. We have an imagination for the future. And when we can imagine the future, that means we can imagine utopia or dystopia. Correct? Both are within our grasp, and we can't help doing it. And our imagination is such that we see connections between how we are living right now and what will happen. So just that dynamic, that we're human beings with a wild and active imagination, means no matter what, we're going to spend time imagining what the future will hold. And when I say the future, I don't necessarily mean 1,000 years from now, but I mean things that are closer to home, like the next election, or the next 10 years, or the next 50 years. Once you get beyond that, it starts to get a little cloudy for most of us, unless you have a really active imagination. And let's combine that with massive changes in culture, like what we're experiencing now, and massive changes in technology. Now, my expertise is in history. And do you know how painstakingly slow it was to move from the Bronze Age to the Iron Age? How much time it took? And it was a massive shakeup in their world, but still moving at a relatively slow pace. And we don't live in that world anymore. I mean, you can remember a time when you didn't have a cell phone, most of you, or didn't have a computer. I remember when my parents had a computer in the house that was plugged into the internet, and it was dial-up. Do you remember that? And then, like, the pictures would load like this, you know? That kind of massive upheaval stokes the imagination. Like, when we realize how vastly different our life really is right now than our grandparents, we start to wonder what will happen. Okay? So I'm just saying it's part of being a human being to imagine the future. Now, let me clear up some misunderstandings about the way I'm using the word apocalypse. Okay? Apocalypse in Greek means to reveal. And if you hear anything that I'm trying to say today, I'm saying the apocalypse and apocalyptic literature and apocalyptic ideas, if they're real, are revealing something about the nature of the way things are. They're not predicting the future. It's like pulling the curtain back and saying, this is actually the case right now, and then using imagination for the future to hammer that home. So let me just say it again. The apocalypse means to reveal. And one of the things that I'd like to suggest is that we're living in a kind of apocalyptic age. We're living in the end times. I'm saying that, I'm laughing because I grew up in a Christian fundamentalist environment where that was a very big deal and people talked about it. My dad wrote a book once, 21 Reasons Why the End Might Come. That was a great might come before the year 2000. Okay, not a lot of people still buying this book. So this is a realm that I've been very uncomfortable with for a long time. So I've tried to shove it down. I've not wanted to ask the questions of why are we doing this? Why do we have imagination for this? And I'm saying something like we're living in an apocalyptic age, and I'm going to give you some evidence for these things. But take it in this way. Something is being revealed. And I'd like to even go even further and make a claim. What do I think is ending in the non-prophetic heart and mind of Kent Dobson, I'm just admitting that, something like Western culture, Western civilization, or you could say the dominance of the West. That's the thing we're bumping into. And I want to tell you something. Human beings and civilizations go through cycles. They go through deaths and resurrections, and it's not pleasant. This is not something to jump up and down about and say, yay, the second coming come round at last. I mean, Yeats is saying a rough beast has come round at last. And when things collapse, if you're a student of history, like the Roman Empire, like the Ottoman Empire, like, well, you start filling in the blank, people suffer. And so this is not something to say, okay, the West has a dark side, yay, it's all going to collapse. No, It's something to be suffered through. And we have to do what Gandalf is saying, which is, what do we do with the time given us? That's the question when things start to get revealed. Like, what is really true? So that's what I'm suggesting. Something like Western dominance is going through the life-death-life cycle of things. Let me make it a little, I was going to say make it lighter. This doesn't make it lighter. One of the first people to turn me on to this idea was a woman named Phyllis Tickle. Have you ever heard of her name? She's Episcopalian. She's a historian. She died a few years ago. Brilliant writer. I had the privilege of meeting her on more than one occasion. And so she had this kind of operating theory. It had more to do with religion. She's a religious scholar, but and particularly with Christianity, but we can broaden it out for a moment. And she says there's something like 500-year cycles that seem to happen. And I'll run you through some. If you go about 500 years before the time of Jesus, you have really an explosion of Greek thought and Buddhist thought and a kind of revolution, kind of spiritual revolution. Fast forward about 500 years, you have the birth of Christianity and really the birth of Judaism, because really something interesting takes place between ancient Hebrew religion and what became Judaism. Go about 500 years after that, you have the collapse of the Roman Empire and the Byzantines. 500 years after that, you have the Crusaders and the conflict with Islam. Islam was already been around for 300 years, but doesn't matter. 500 years later, you have the Reformation. She said, so if there's something like 500-year cycles, which is a cyclical way of looking at things, we're due for a kind of disaster, a kind of reformation, you could say. And I want to say something about the Reformation because I think it's related to some seeds I'm trying to drop here. One of the reasons why the Reformation worked, and I don't mean it reformed the Catholic Church. People just said, well, we'll just go away and do our own thing. One of the reasons why it worked was the printing press. That's why it worked. Not the 95 Theses, not ideological ideas. It worked because of the printing press. That's why. That is a technologically grounded revolution in thought. And it changed people's worldview. It changed the way people lived. Now, you think that was a revolution? The printing press? Think how long it would take to make a book. Do you know what a printing press actually is? You know, arranging all the little letters and running it through the little, I was going to say machine. I mean, it's a whole art form and craft, and it changed the world. And just think about what's happening now when it comes to technology. You can understand how a printing press works. Oh, you take a little metal block and you put ink on it and it goes on a piece of paper. Paper had been around since, who was the first to invent? Well, I guess parchment. I don't need to go down that rabbit trail. It's been around for a while, okay? Versions of paper, papyrus and parchment. But you and I do not understand how technology works right now. We really don't. Do you know what an algorithm is? You're like, yeah, no. So I'm saying that's partly what's at hand. And that is disrupting things on a massive scale. Our worldview, our ideas, our sense of power, our lack of power, who's in control, who am I related to, what is the global economy that I'm all tied up in. You've seen those ships out, pictures of it on the news out there, you know, bring our ships into the port to give us things we don't need from China or whatever. I don't know exactly what's happening, but it's like we don't even understand the way the world works when we go to the convenience store and buy something. It's kind of hidden, and things are changing so rapidly that there's a crack. I'm saying it's an apocalyptic crack. It's a crack in Western civilization. It's a crack in worldview. Here are examples. I'm going to fly through these. Here's evidence. I'm trying to make a case that we're living in the end times. By the way, if you want some comfort, I don't actually want to be comforting right now, but I'll give you some comfort. Michael Mead, he's the great mythologist, I refer to him from time to time. Michael Mead says, the great thing, it's like kind of good news and bad news. The bad news is something like, there is such thing as an apocalypse, and things can get bad, and things do die, and civilizations crash. The good news, sort of, is that the end is never the end, because that's just not the way of nature. It's just not the way of nature. The end is never the end. It's always the birth of something else, even if you don't like what's being born. So and that's just a simple way of saying it is a cycle. So here's evidence. Our stories do not hold. I'm saying this as a historian. If you look at the collapse of major empires, what starts to collapse is the story that held the thing together. And I can just say, we know that's the case. Whatever the American story is, it's not holding up. Because right now you would say, it depends on who you talk to, whatever the American story is, correct? And when you start to lose these kind of binding narratives, things can spin. There's a great Egyptian story about this, the story of Osiris. I'm not going to tell you the whole thing, but Osiris's brother, his name is Set, S-E-T, and he's evil, okay? And one day, he tears Osiris to bits and throws him to the underworld, scatters him all over the place. It's kind of a graphic story. I'm giving you the child's version. But Set is the spirit of destruction for destruction's sake. And sometimes when civilizations, and that's what this story is in part about, the Egyptian story, are under pressure, the spirit of Set can take over and want to burn the whole thing to the ground. And just look around at dimensions of our culture and say, are there any people possessed by the spirit of Set that would want to burn the whole thing down? Okay? It's part of the evidence that the story's not holding up very well. Okay. Here are examples of stories that aren't holding up. What does it mean to be an American? You don't have to answer that, but just think about it. What is a democracy? See, already we're saying it depends on who you ask, correct? What about this phrase? This is a phrase that has been striking me lately. The leader of the free world. Think. What world? And who's free? Here's a very dark statistic. More people are imprisoned in the United States of America than any country on earth, including China, including Russia. That does it openly. Dissidents, put them in prison. So you think, the leader of, well, who's free? Do you hear what I'm saying? So that story, it starts to crack. I'm not even saying it's untrue. I'm just, it's like the boat is leaking. Okay. Here's another piece of evidence that's apocalyptic, revealing. Our language starts to get slippery and we don't know what we mean by things anymore. Some of the things I just mentioned. Here's a line from the Bible. Our fathers have eaten sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. In times of apocalypse, there can be messianic ideas. Okay? Like someone will save us. A leader, a figure, or our own ingenuity. Here's one of the things that I think is being pushed against with progress, for example, the myth of progress, we could say, which is, don't worry, technology will save us. I remember way back, in the 90s, I started doing some reading about nuclear waste, because nuclear technology is actually quite, on the one hand, environmentally friendly. On the other hand, it makes poison that never goes away. And I remember reading legitimate scientific articles that were saying, don't worry, we'll figure out what to do with this in due time. That's part of what's cracking, because that was a very strong theme. Don't worry, technology will fix this down the road. When what tends to happen is that we end up hiding it from ourselves. or we throw it into space. That was a great solution. We'll just fly all of our waste up into space. I mean, talk about a metaphor of insanity. Okay. Let me say one more thing about, since I mentioned nuclear. One of the things that's so troubling right now, and why I say it's a bit of an apocalyptic time, it's revealing something, is that not even the ancient writer of the book of Revelation, John, could imagine a disaster like nuclear annihilation. Read the book of Revelation. It doesn't compare to what could happen right now with if human beings started pushing buttons. That really is true. And you and I don't want to look at that. Who would want to? Because it's like looking in the mirror and saying, we have created this. So we don't want to look at it. I mean, and I'm not saying you have to spend all your time, you know, in fear. In fact, what Charity was describing, I think, is absolutely the right move, which is there's a relationship between fear and service. And if you say, what can we do with the time given us? The fear lessens. And we can act in the world, and we can start asking questions like, is it a good idea to have more nuclear weapons in the hands of 7, now 8 nations, more power than, what's the right way of putting it, that can destroy everything on earth? Is that a good idea? It's saying, don't worry, I promise you, I won't use it. Anyway. My main point right now is that reality also cracks what we mean by Western civilization, Western dominance. Don't worry, reason will win in the end. Okay. Here's another example straight from the line of Yeats. An apocalyptic age looks like this. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Of course, that doesn't describe our current political climate at all. Okay, that's enough of evidence that we're living in an apocalyptic age. I challenge you to think of your own. I have a much longer list, but I don't want this to be 10 hours of apocalyptic threats. So here's some questions I want to kind of end with. One of the strange things, this is an intuition I have, is that when our narratives start to fall apart, this sounds like the wrong move, but I think it's the right move, this is just my opinion, is it's important to look back and say, what birthed all this in the first place? And let's sort through. Is there anything good? Because we could be taken over by the spirit of Set and say, burn everything to the ground. Everything. Nothing can be trusted. And I don't think that's very healthy. I think it's something like, is there anything good? I like the word sacred. Is there anything sacred that has brought us this far? Because those are the kinds of seeds that will go into the ground for whatever comes next. I'm not saying you have to even worry about what comes next. We have to do what Gandalf said. What do we do with the time given us? Look, our grandkids, our great-grandkids, the next generation, they're going to have to worry about stuff. And guess what? They're going to have to worry about stuff when that time comes. We have to worry about now. And part of that requires a kind of sorting. How do we get here? What ideas are worth hanging on to? What ways of looking at the world don't work anymore, but what have to be recovered or maintained or promoted or held onto as something worthy of putting in the pocket of the next generation. So you carry this. And that's a very challenging thing to do, but that would be part of facing up to the apocalypse, because if it's revealing something, we want to say, okay, what's here? So in part, I'm saying we have to look back. We have to say, how do we get here? What's worth listening to. Here's another idea. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. The falcon cannot hear the falconer. I don't know what you think about this line. I don't know what I think about this line. The falcon cannot hear the falconer. What does that mean exactly? Can we live without a falconer? Is it a good idea to live without a falconer? And if we just do some translation, I think what Yeats is saying, although he's very hard to read, and you could tell just by reading through that poem, you start to get like, you know, he's stirring his own mythic cauldron, and we're not used to hearing things like that. In part, what he means is the source, or we might say the divine, or we might say God, or we might say the sacred. It's, in some respects, the story of Icarus hidden inside this poem. Icarus has wings made by his father to get out of the labyrinth, but the joints are made of wax. And the higher he flies, and his father tells him, don't fly too high. That's the ancient wisdom that I'm saying we still need to listen to. Don't fly too high, but he can't hear it. The falcon cannot hear the falconer. We think, just keep going upwards. That's the myth of progress. Just keep flying higher. Let's go to Mars. I got to tell you my honest opinion. I think it's insanity. I think it's Icarus. To do what? To conquer that place? To mine it for whatever it has? To get out of here? The answer is usually because we can. That's Icarus. And what can happen is the joints start to melt and you crash into the sea. And when that happens to civilizations and cultures, there's a lot of suffering. So I'm asking a genuine question. Can we live without a falconer? I'm not exactly saying, can we live without God? But I'm kind of saying something like that. What is the source? To what are we connected? What is the sacred? What is sacred? That's a question that was coming up in the last series. But what is sacred? What do we mean by such a thing? Are human beings, what's that poem, the masters of their fate and the captains of their soul? You know that poem? I had to memorize that when I was a freshman in high school. I can't really remember it right now. I am the captain of my fate, you know. In some ways, that's Icarus. And Yeats is saying, when you fly like this and you forget your own humanity, your own source, your own connectedness to the earth, the fact that every single breath that you take and every drop of water that you drink, you did not make, no human being made, when you fly that high, you crash. So Yeats is warning us. I wonder when he wrote this poem. I should have looked it up. Really, I don't know why I thought 1913. Well, 1921. Dang. It's amazing. Once again, technology. We can't even imagine that that would be possible. I'd have to go to the freaking library. You know? 1 second. There it is, 1921. So after World War I. And just before World War II. And the 20th century and all that it gave us and took from us. And he's standing like an apocalyptic prophet in the middle of this saying, do you want to keep flying around and around, not connected to anything? Real or true? Here's my final image and I'm done. I'm asking a question like, what needs to be remembered? In the age of the apocalypse, what needs to be remembered? In the story of Eros and Psyche, Psyche, in order to get back together with Eros, has to do these impossible tasks, and one of them is to sort all these seeds, and she can't quite do it and has to get the help of mice. That's the age we live in. We need help sorting. We don't know what's true. We don't know what to remember. We don't know what's worth passing on. We don't know what to question. It's a lot of little work, you know, a lot of sorting of seeds, and you have to do your own sorting in the time given you. So that wasn't the image I was going to share. truth in Greek is a river of memory in the underworld. It's a river in the underworld. Do you feel how different that is than like the truth is out there somewhere and I need to discover it? The Greeks were saying it flows underground. And when you remember something, you find the truth. Now, you know this feeling because sometimes you can't remember things. And then when you do remember, it's like, oh, I remember. And it feels good. Why does it feel good? Because you're remembering the truth. That's why. And I'm saying something like this. Somewhere underground, no matter what age we find ourselves in, and I think it's a kind of apocalyptic age, there is a flowing memory of truth somewhere down there. And it takes a certain amount of courage to say, like listening for the falconer, what has been with us that's still feeding us? Like an underground stream of what's true that we want to flow into the future and not forget all about. I think that's where I want to end. Let me just read the opening paragraph. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world, and the blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the first worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand, surely the second coming, the second coming. Hardly are those words out of my mouth when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in the sands of the desert, a shape with a lion body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun is moving its slow thighs. Well, all about it, real shadows of indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again. But now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep, you see how he's looking back to the past? What needs to be remembered? 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle, like a war. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born. Thanks.